The Nature of Dragons by Arthur Rybak. If you have any feedback or comments, please email me at arthurrybak@proton.me. My email can be found in the audio drama's description. Chapter 3. Falahara's green room is located on the third floor of the shining white cliff face that houses the university. It has rows upon rows of broad, intricately carved tables with green velvet armchairs and silver lamps with domes of emerald glass, two per table. Each lamp has a small jar beneath its shade, and in each jar dances a tiny golden spark. A warm glow from dozens of floating globes illuminate every available surface. Depending on where one stands, a few of the globes will flock to them and follow them around, offering the perfect reading light. The bookshelves here are dedicated to foreign literature gathered from all five corners of the world. It is said to be the only collection in the lands to contain all the forgotten languages. It does not, of course, no one library can contain all that has been forgotten, but it is a nice sentiment nonetheless. The room is far larger than it seems at first glance, but one can only learn this by touching a specific book on a specific shelf in a specific way. It's an old weathered copy of The Hemispheres of Gareth on the second shelf from the far window. If you run your ring finger gently down its spine, the wall beside the shelf will lose its matter, and you'll be able to step right through it into the real green room. But visitors are not told this. And as a visitor, an unwanted one at that, Daniel, of course, has not been told. He is standing slightly hunched over, examining the leather-bound tomes lining the wall to the left of the door. Having very little professional education, most of the languages are foreign to him, though he thinks perhaps the spidery script of these particular books is Dalin. Once, in his childhood, when the ports of Inar were still brimming with ships from the south, a thin, sleek vessel from the city-state of Dal docked to restock its supplies before starting on what was, as Daniel had been told, or perhaps made believe, a magnificent journey around the world. On its sides, inscribed in golden, sinuous writing were prayers to keep men safe at sea. He still does not know the fate of the ship, as it never did return to Inar, and Daniel, though taken by the occasional fancy of pirates and faraway lands, couldn't bring himself to venture out of the city to go in search of it. Until last week, that is, when a great need finally forced him onto one of the boats he had watched as a child with such fearful longing, to go all the way north, to the largest university in the lands. Daniel pulls one of the books from its shelf, opening it on a random page, he inspects the script, and though it does look like Dalin, "I was not aware you read Cree," a cool, smooth voice says behind him, "Master Daniel." Daniel blinks in surprise. He snaps the tome shut and lays it onto a table by his side, turning slowly. A man in a long black coat is standing by one of the tall windows, turned away from him. Though he cannot see his face, Daniel knows that his name is Simon Septine, because this is the man he's here to see. This is the man, he has been told, that can bring all his dreams to life. For a fee, of course. But then, we all know everything comes at a price. "They call me Lord Daniel these days," he says to Simon, drawing out his words, as though Simon had not just taken his breath with his unexpected appearance. "Even so," draws Simon, "a lord you are not, yet." "Yet," thinks Daniel, a warm glow blooming in his chest at the word. Simon turns to face him. He is lean, as though someone's been stretching him out. His 40-odd years are just beginning to show in the lines of his ugly face. Not at all what Daniel expected from one of the world's most respected mercenaries. He imagined a giant of a man bigger than the Maker himself, an indestructible force. Daniel can probably snap Simon in two. The globes of light scatter, avoiding the spinner as he crosses the room to sit in one of the velvet armchairs facing Daniel. "I may have not been ennobled under my country's law," says Daniel, taking the chair across from him. He's not sure he should sit, though he does not allow himself to hesitate because this is what lords do. Treat all the world as their equal. "But with your help, we will change the laws in Nolim, legitimizing my title." "You will forgive me," says Simon, "if I do not address you by a false title until then." Daniel does not forgive him. He has given years of his life to count for something, to matter. And good grace, the world should know. the entire world should know. Daniel watches Spinner Septine for a moment, but the man says nothing else. Waiting. I'm told that if I want a job done well, Daniel starts, and, discreetly, you are the man to approach. Simon stays silent. He steeps his fingers beneath his chin, his black eyes glittering in the reflected globes of light. Daniel takes a breath, says, I have a commission for you, Spinner Septine, with considerably more confidence than he is feeling. Yes, I gathered, says Simon. How much? Daniel balks at his directness. You don't want to know the details of the campaign? He asks, trying to mask his surprise. You know nothing of myself or my cause. Do you not wish to learn about me, about my plans? Perhaps you will find them distasteful. I find most causes, and most people for that matter, distasteful, Master Daniel. But I do not work to satisfy my taste or to uphold your cause. Nor will I reframe the morality of your issue in order to help you clear your conscience. Whether you can sleep at night is no concern of mine. I work if I find the money interesting. If not, I do not. I do not care if you want to save the world or destroy it. He gives a dismissive wave of his hand. Save your guilty conscience for someone who cares. Daniel blinks at him for a moment. He desperately wants to argue, wants to explain that what he's doing is for the greater good, that his plan matters. Then he exhales, sits back, and takes a moment to collect himself. What should he say? What can he say to get this man to see? Do I even need him to see? Daniel wonders. After all, I don't expect a knife to understand my reasoning before I slit a throat. Daniel's brown eyes begin to sparkle in a way they haven't in months. This man can get him what he wants without asking him the questions he's been asking himself. This man will get him what he wants, and he won't expect Daniel to apologize for it. As for the details of your movement, Simon goes on, I already know them, as does anyone who has bothered to pay even the slightest bit of attention to the goings-on in Nolim. I very much doubt, says Daniel. You and your comrades have been far from subtle, says Simon, giving Daniel a disparaging look. It is a wonder that you have not all been rounded up and executed. If you are so well informed, says Daniel with a laugh, pray tell, why am I here? Simon sighs, rolls his eyes. On the 6th of Septmus, you and 5 others met in the Singing Bee on Round Street in Nolim's capital, Inar. Among your companions was Lord Bane, who is bankrolling your little coup. Who, by the way, promised you, Daniel, not only a title, but the Nolim crown. The men you met with are the biggest, how do I put this, fans of the little speeches you give in dingy pubs around the capital. And so, the 5 of you decided to turn your words to action. What is it that bothers you? Asks Simon, touching an index finger to his chin in a parody of thinking, ah yes, that the queen feasts while her people starve? Personally, I think the fact that your country has broken up into warring counties is by far the bigger issue. And you're not starving, really. Some of the separatist counties are far worse off than even Inar's beggars. Daniel's eyes widen in outrage. He opens his mouth to protest. But Simon, under the mistaken impression that Daniel is nothing more than a peasant, continues right over him. But why should you come up with something new when this sentiment has been tried and tested by so many usurpers before you? And this is it, the line that Daniel is unwilling to cross. I am no usurper, he snarls, fingers digging into the soft velvet of the armrests as he jerks forward, nearly rising from his seat in anger. Of course not. You are their savior, says Simon with a mocking smirk. If you do not believe, as I have said, says Simon, voice cold and unaffected. It is not my job to believe in your cause. I offer a service, one that does not include coddling, nor does it include false camaraderie, or, God forbid, respect. Once my fee is transferred to my vaults, I will happily forget all about you, your commission, and your special little hopes and dreams. Then what guarantee do I have of your loyalty? Asks Daniel, trying to stay calm. Because he was warned that Simon would be difficult. and not to react in the way he would instinctively want to. So he quashes his instincts, grinding his teeth. "To you?" Simon laughs. "What an absurd notion. I am loyal to myself. Perhaps to the university, so long as it houses me. But I am a man of my word." Daniel imagines himself rising, saying, "I do not deal with scum," and walking out. What a satisfaction it would be, preserving his pride, but one does not gain crowns by being prideful. So he stays and waits, using Simon's own tactic of spreading time against him, not that it affects the spinner in the slightest. "Very well," he says eventually, "you will help us take Inner. I want you to make sure the crown finds its way onto no head but mine. And then you'll secure for me the fidelity of the Fiats. I will not have them start an uprising. Your contract will be up once Boflavin Air signs a treaty." "If you need me to get Boflavin Air and his Fiats on your side, what chance do you have with the rest of the population?" "The Fiats are fighting men," says Daniel, "not thinking men. They've sworn their oaths of loyalty to the Queen, and they will stick to them. If we do not force them to our side, they will never cross over." "And if they still refuse?" asks Simon. "Then I want you to kill them." Simon raises an eyebrow. "You understand what you are asking?" he says. "I am asking you to kill the Fiats." "You are asking me to kill the best trained soldiers in the lands," says Simon, looking thoughtfully over Daniel's shoulder, then his eyes refocus on him. "That will reflect both in my fee and in the troops you will provide me. Your personal army of mercenaries is training as we speak. Once you arrive in the capital, you may take over if you wish." "Yes. I'll send you the list of equipment I expect to find upon my arrival, and I will need studies drawn up on every man and woman you give me. Everything. Body type. Strengths. Weaknesses. Interests. Family. Their reasons for joining you." Daniel watches Simon for a long while. That much information can destroy the movement if Queen Adim decides to hire Simon out from under him. Then again, he already has enough information to destroy them. Anything else will do no more than facilitate the task. He's gambling his head in all this. He may as well go all in. He nods. Simon shrugs a shoulder. "How many other spinners will you be commissioning for this endeavor?" he asks. "Two," Daniel replies. "Marcus Blackland of Uid and Regalt Cleave. So you won't be alone, but you will lead them. Naturally." "Of course," Simon says, nodding. "And the rest of your party, they can control the Sela." "Some more than others," says Daniel, "but none enough to be of use to you. Most can do little more spinning than is needed for basic household chores." "Disappointing," Simon sighs. "Very well. How much are you offering?"
10,000 gold crowns, Daniel informs him. "A fifth now, the rest once I'm on the throne." A hefty sum. Enough for most men to live comfortably for a year.
25,000, says Simon. 15,000 now. I am not negotiating with you, Daniel. That is my only offer.
Daniel looks at the man. He has heard that Spinner Septine delivers unthinkable, unbelievable results, that his lack of compassion extends to both sides of whatever conflict he is being paid to partake in. With this man on his side, Daniel can already feel the weight of the Nolim crown resting on his head. And as for loyalty, well, that he can win. After all, he's got a pretty good track record.
"Done," Daniel says, sitting up straighter in his chair.
Simon nods and pulls a scroll from a wooden box that is abruptly sitting on the table beside them, along with two quills, an empty inkwell, and two thin silver blades. The glowing globes gather above the table, illuminating it. Daniel goes over the contract. It holds the standard terms of commission. He finds it incredible that this man knew how the negotiations would go before they even met. Or perhaps it is just a trick of the Sela he's never heard of, filling in the contract as they spoke. He picks up one of the blades. Daniel's never signed a blood contract, but Lord Bane talked him through it. It ensures that the terms are honored by both parties, the schema in the parchment temporarily bonding them to each other. If both sides of the agreement are upheld, the parchment will dissolve along with the bond. If not, Simon will be able to track Daniel to the ends of the earth until he fulfills his end. On the other hand, if Spinner Septim deserts, it will render all attempts to complete the payment futile, and tomorrow's deposit will be retracted. Simple and clear. Daniel slices open his palm, pouring his blood into the ink vial. Simon takes his bleeding hand when he is done, and with an imperceptible schema closes the wound. Daniel winces. Having near to no ability with the Scylla, healing doesn't hurt him, not the way it hurts Spinner's, but it is, nonetheless, an unpleasant, invasive sensation, feeling his skin knitting shut. "Thank you," he says, glancing at the man. He suddenly feels small, staring into those cold, dark eyes. Perhaps Spinner Septim is a force to be reckoned with after all. The inkwell slides over to Simon, who picks up the second blade, drawing it down his own palm and pours his blood into the vial. He reaches into one of the pockets of his black coat and pulls out a vat of salve. He rubs the thick greenish ointment into the gash. The bleeding stops. Even if Daniel could offer healing, the Master Spinner would not accept it. The body perceives healing as an attack, so the more access to the Scylla a person has, the harder their body fights the healing. The harder the body fights, the worse the pain. Closing the cut would cause Simon twice as much pain as the original laceration had. Simon shuts the inkwell, shakes it, and places it beside the parchment, flipping the silver cap open once more. He picks up one of the quills, dips. The blood on the shining silver tip is thick and red. He signs his name. Daniel hesitates. He can still turn back, can still return to Inar, live out the rest of his life as an average citizen of a crumbling country. But no, he will have the crown, and it will be worth it. Daniel dips the tip of his quill into their blood and signs the document. The signatures begin to shine an eerie, luminescent white. Then the parchment floats up, off the table, and, in a flash of blinding light, is gone.